John 2, starting in verse 1. On the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples. And when the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now there were 6 stone water jars for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. And Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." And they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast." So they took it. When the master of the feast tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. After this, he went down to Capernaum with his mother and his brothers and his disciples, and they stayed there for a few days. This is the word of the Lord. So we know that John has a very specific motivation as he's writing this gospel. He explains his kind of mission statement at the end of chapter 20. He says, "Now Jesus did many other things in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name." So John is not claiming to have every story or every instance of what Jesus did included in his gospel, but what he has included, he's included for a reason and for a purpose. So when we look at the story, we know then that it can't be so small or random that it doesn't matter. It's included for 2 important reasons that every story in John is. First, so that we can believe that Jesus is the Son of God, and second, so that we can find life in him. We actually see that happening within the story, right? In verse 11, "This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him." We can see it happening within the story. So why is this important? How does this lead us to believing in Jesus and finding our life in him? The story tells us that Jesus is the true and better version of 2 very relatable things. First, Jesus is the perfect groom, and second, Jesus provides the perfect feast. So first, Jesus is the perfect groom. My parents are here today, and I couldn't help thinking about this exchange between Jesus and his mom and how that would have gone if it was me and my mom. See, Mary, and she knows who Jesus is, just like Celia says. She knows that Jesus is capable of these things, and she notices this problem, and she asks Jesus to help out, saying they've run out of wine. And then how does Jesus respond? He says, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." Now, that's a pretty aggressive response. I'm 31 years old, and if I started a line to my mom calling her woman, I'd be very fearful about the repercussions. I don't think that would go over well. And so some people, scholars, have disagreed. Like, is this an aggressive response? Is this an appropriate response? But a lot of people are saying, like, no, like, our translations are trying to make it seem like Jesus is not being a little bit of a jerk here, but in fact, he kind of is being a little disrespectful to his mother. It's an aggressive response, and I think it points to this idea that Jesus is somewhat stressed in this moment. Now, I used to read this story, and I would always think that he's a little bit stressed because he's saying that this occasion, this wedding, is not important enough for me to do a miracle, or maybe he's saying that it's not yet time to reveal himself as someone who's capable of doing miracles. I always thought that's why he was saying, "My hour has not yet come." But a while ago, I listened to a sermon by Pastor Tim Keller on this text, and he made a very compelling case that actually Jesus is distracted and stressed by something entirely different. What Keller says is that, I think he's right, is that Jesus, it can't be true that Jesus was not ready to perform miracles yet, since he ends up performing the miracle, but that he reacts roughly to his mom's suggestion because his mind was a million miles away. He was so distracted because he was thinking about his own wedding. In the same way we do, think about when you go to a wedding. When you're at a wedding, you might think back to your own wedding, or you might think forward to your own wedding if you're not married, or you might think about, I want to do the same thing at mine or my child's wedding or my grandchild's wedding. And I know what you're thinking. You're saying, yeah, Tim, sure, the last wedding I went to, I was thinking about how glad I was that I got the bacon-wrapped scallops instead of the weird cracker paste thing as an appetizer. But Jesus never got married, so that's a really silly point. But and we're right, Jesus didn't get married the same way that we think about marriages, but we know because of all of the marriage metaphors in the Bible and the bride and groom language that Jesus did become a groom, and we were the bride, that he eventually does get married. And when he says here, "My hour has not yet come," he's thinking on this huge eternal scale of his wedding, of his marriage with the church, and the cost of that wedding and what that will mean for his life. See, the word for hour here in John almost always has these eschatological, has these big, important connotations. It almost always refers to the hour of Jesus' death. So when Jesus is thinking about, is at this wedding, he's thinking about how in order for him to be a bridegroom, he's going to have to die. When he's surrounded by this wedding and talking about turning water, thinking about turning water into wine, he knows that back in the Old Testament, God, through Moses, turned water into blood. And he knows that Jesus knows that it's going to have to happen again, and it's going to be his blood. So right after this text, in chapter 3, a lot of people go back to John the Baptist, who we talked about last week, and they ask John how he feels about all of his followers leaving him to follow Jesus. And John basically says, "Great. The bride belongs to the bridegroom." Still this wedding imagery. "I am just the friend of the bridegroom who's rejoicing now that the groom is here." See, Jesus is the groom for all of us. He's the perfect groom that we've been waiting for. In college, I thought of myself as a little bit of a matchmaker, and I remember friends always telling me what they were looking for in a potential spouse, and everybody had this ideal person in their mind. But whether you've been married or whether you haven't been married, I think we all know the truth that there's no such thing as a perfect spouse. We all have problems and struggles and issues or annoying factors that make us very difficult to live with and make us very disappointing as partners, except for Jenny, who I think is here this morning. But there's no such thing as this spouse who is perfect, who doesn't disappoint us. Just like there's no such thing as a perfect marriage except for the marriage that we have with Christ, except for Christ as our groom and us as the bride. He is the perfect groom. Second, I want to talk about how Jesus is providing the perfect feast. And before we dive into the how Jesus is doing providing the perfect feast, I want to apologize briefly. In seminary, they kind of drill you that you're supposed to always have 3 points to your sermon, and those 3 points are supposed to be about the same length. It's supposed to help people remember them. But this week, I was in there, I found 2 points, and the second point is a lot longer than the first point. So I'm sorry, we're going to have to pay attention regardless. But don't worry, I have the second point. I broke it down into 3 sub-points. So I want to talk about how Jesus provides this perfect feast, and I want to do it by talking about what does he do, why does he do it, and how does he do it. So first, what does he do to provide this perfect feast? And the answer is, he functions as the master of the feast. That's an interesting term here found in our text, right? Master of the feast. What does that really mean? It's actually not the host of the feast. It's not the person who's throwing the feast. See, the story, the master of the feast was a unique role at that time in Jewish culture. And when Jesus is changing the water into wine, he tells the servants to draw it out and give it to the master of the feast without telling him where the wine came from. So the master of the feast is kind of this master of ceremonies. He's in between the wedding planner and just like a really good time person who makes sure that everybody else has fun. It's kind of, he's a guest, but he's also responsible for making sure that the feast goes well and that it's fun for everyone. So when Jesus solves the problem of the party, like Celia describes, when he solves the problem of not having enough cake or not having enough wine, he's actually functioning as the master of the feast to ensure that the feast goes well, that the ceremony goes well, that people are having a good time. He's miraculously providing more wine and functioning as this master of the feast. Now, I ran out of wine over Christmas. We were hosting Jenny's family, and just as we were sitting down for Christmas dinner, we realized we were out of red wine, and that was a little bit embarrassing, not too embarrassing, but it would have been a lot more embarrassing at a wedding, right? But still, it doesn't seem that this should be significant enough to merit a miracle by Jesus. It still feels kind of like a like a social situation that's like slightly embarrassing. Maybe you like you wouldn't walk around your neighborhood for a couple of weeks, but eventually you could hold your head up high again. In fact, this seems to contradict who we think of as Jesus. Not only is there alcohol involved, don't tell the Baptist, but it shows that Jesus cares about the people of this wedding. He cares about them enough to ensure that they can drink and have a good time. It shows that he cares enough about these small things, these seemingly insignificant things. How often do we think about Jesus the other way? We read what he's saying, and he's talking about suffering and sacrifice and obedience that's required in following him. Those things are all true, but it doesn't mean that he loses sight of the small things that are a major part of our lives. So why does he do this? Why does he care about turning water into wine? Why does this matter at all to Jesus? Why does he care about saving the feast and helping the groom and the guest have a good time? First, because the small things that seem insignificant still matter to Jesus. Jesus says in the Gospel of Luke, "Are not five sparrows sold for 2 pennies? Yet not one of them is forgotten by God. Even the hairs on your head are numbered. Fear not, because you are more important than sparrows." See, Jesus doesn't just care about the big things. He cares about all of the things. Another reason Jesus acts as the master of the feast is because he is preparing us to taste the ultimate feast. Feast language is really common in the Bible, especially in the Gospel of John. I had one of my advisors in undergrad actually wrote a scholarly book on feasts in the Gospel of John, and it's not a very fun book to read, but let me give you the cliff notes. There are a lot of feasts in the Gospel of John, and they're very important. It's not just John. The Bible is full of this feast language, of these phrases like the one in Psalm 34, "Taste and see that the Lord is good." And we have all this feasting and tasting language because we're supposed to experience God's kingdom, God's grace, in a very physical way. Jonathan Edwards talked a lot about why the Bible uses this experiential language or this culinary metaphors. He came up with an analogy himself involving honey. He said, "I can show you honey. I can let you look at it. You can ooh and ah over its golden hue, the way the light bounces off of it, and the way it radiates a beautiful glow, and I can tell you that it's sweet, and you can believe that it's sweet when I tell you that it is, but unless you have tasted it, you don't really know it is sweet. You can't believe it is sweet because I told you. But believing honey is sweet doesn't mean that you really know it is sweet. I could be lying to you. You only truly know honey is sweet when you have tasted it." And that's these metaphors, these tasting, the metaphor that is so important to the feast that Jesus invites us to. Jesus invites us to a wonderful feast so that we can taste the kingdom of God, so that we can experience it and start to hunger for it, so that we can start to delight in it, and we can start to find our satisfaction in it. So finally, how does he do it? I think this is the most surprising part of this text to me. How does he function as the master of the feast? How does he provide this perfect feast? He leads us to experience the feast, not by sending us back to Sunday school, not by saying, actually, if you look back at Habakkuk, there's something really enlightening for you to study, but by showing his power in this seemingly secular fashion. See, the tension is going to be very present as we walk through the Gospel of John. This idea that it's also present in the prodigal God study. On one hand, we are called to obey God and to grow in our understanding and our knowledge and obedience, just to act like the older brother in some ways and be obedient to God and learn. And if you're sitting here and you're not deepening your relationship with God, if you're not growing in your knowledge of the Bible and your knowledge of God, then you're not really living the Christian life. Especially as Presbyterians, it's something we put a high value on, learning and reforming our understanding, constantly experiencing who God is. But on the other hand, when Jesus points out again and again that we erect these divisions in our lives, we put up barriers between the things we see as secular and the things that we see as holy, there's sort of false paradigms. If we look back at how Jesus acts, as he's acting as the master of the feast, he takes these ceremonial jugs and he fills them with water and he turns them into wine. And it says these jars were meant for ritual cleanness, ritual purification. Yet Jesus uses them to make wine at a party. Now, that was definitely against Jewish customs, because we love to differentiate between secular and spiritual. We like to separate the unclean from the clean, the sinful from the holy, because it allows us to feel better about ourselves and allows us to put a barrier between ourselves and other people. We can say that that group of people or that lifestyle or a people of that country or that denomination or that political perspective aren't really a part of God's worldview. They're not really part of us. But that's more like how the Pharisees and the religious officials, the enemies of Christ, acted in the Gospels. It's not how Jesus did ministry and reached out. See, Jesus provides the perfect feast. He did not see the same distinctions between secular and spiritual that we try to impose on our lives. It's actually a very radical way that he interacted with the world. So what did he do? He served as the master of the feast. He did it so that we might taste the kingdom of God. And how did he do it? By destroying our paradigms of the secular and the holy. So how does this change the way that we should interact with God and each other? How does this idea that God is Christ is supreme, not only over things of the church, not only over things of our lives, but over all things, how does that change the way that we interact with each other and with him? First, let's treat him like the perfect bridegroom. Now, some of us are uneasy when we use the marriage metaphor in church. Maybe you were married, but you've lost your spouse, or you've gone through a divorce, or maybe you want to be married, but you're not. Maybe some of you are still married, but you're disappointed in your marriage in some way. But I don't think that this should feel like an insult to any of us, because the marriage we're talking about with Jesus surpasses all of our marital statuses. Even if you feel like you're happily married, that marriage pales in comparison to the marriage where Christ is the groom. It doesn't matter if you're single, you're divorced, you're widowed, if you're unhappily or happily married, you have this opportunity, this invitation to be a part of the perfect wedding, the perfect marriage, to be unified to the one who will never disappoint. All we need to do is to put our faith in him. Second, we must understand that he is providing the perfect feast. We need to let go of all of the excuses we have, we prop up in our lives to keep us from committing to him and learning from him. I don't know how many times I've heard excuses for why people stop going to church, because either they've gone through something really difficult and God didn't stop it, which means that to them that God doesn't care, or because they want to have fun and they feel like the Christian community and Christianity doesn't allow them room for what they want to do. See, God cares about, this text shows us that God cares about all of the small things in our life. So certainly he cares about the big things, the things that have a profound impact in our lives. So whatever hardships we experience in our lives, they don't mean that God does not care for us. We are all precious to him. And for those who want to eat, drink, and be merry, we see here Jesus functioning as this master of the feast, throwing this glorious party. And we see this language again and again throughout the Bible. Yes, there might be suffering and there's obedience, but there's also amazing celebration and joy and happiness that Jesus is the master of the feast and providing the best party that we could imagine. Because Jesus is providing this perfect feast, we need to let go of these reasons for not committing, and we need to taste his glory. So I just have a quick diagnostic as we finish up here. I want you to ask a couple questions of yourself, and think about this and think about your life. Are you thirsting for God's kingdom? Is that a thirst inside of you? Do you find your delight in God and in his presence? And finally, are you finding your satisfaction from him, or are you looking elsewhere to be filled? If the answer to any of those is no, that's okay. But it means that we need to work harder to experience his feast and his glory. And the only way I know to do that is to abide in him. We'll talk about this later on in John with the vine and the branches. But we need to get plugged in. And we can do that through worship. We can do that through the discipleship opportunities we talked about at the beginning of the service, getting plugged in and learning more about him. We can do it through service and reaching out to the community and serving people in need. Or we can even do it through fellowship. We can invite each other into our homes, and we can share, break bread together, and spend time together. So this week, I want to challenge us all to make a move towards the feast of Jesus, doing something that we don't normally do, whether that's committing to some sort of individual practice, like reading the Bible every day for a week, or praying every day for a week. Maybe it's going to one of the discipleship opportunities we have at Fairview. Maybe it's by inviting another person from church over for dinner and sharing a little bit about your story and sharing more about what God is doing in your life. But we all need to reach out. We need to taste and see that the Lord is good, because he is the master of the feast, he is the perfect groom, and he is inviting us to the perfect feast.